August 20th, 1978 was a hot and humid day in Newark, New Jersey. As the afternoon approached, five teenage friends got together at Westside Park to play a few games of basketball. 17-year-olds Melvin Pittman and Ernest Taylor were joined by their 16-year-old friends Alvin Turner, Randy Johnson, and Michael McDowell. The group of friends had been tight since childhood, and it was the normal summer routine to spend every day together, hanging out, playing sports, and even working with some local repairmen to make a few extra bucks. As afternoon turned into night, the friends made plans to meet up after they'd grabbed dinner, showered, and changed their clothes. Amongst the plans for that evening was to help out a local carpenter with the moving of some boxes, at which time they'd get some cash to have a good time with for the rest of the evening. Several of the boys returned home and then left, but never returned again. Others stayed out, and also vanished into the darkness of that summer night. Witnesses reported seeing the boys in various places across town throughout the night, but what became of them would become a dark mystery that haunted the streets of Newark for years to come. How could five friends, who'd lived in the area all of their lives, simply vanish without a trace? Over the next 33 years, investigators would struggle to answer that question while fighting against unsubstantiated tips, the directions of alleged psychics, and later, two confessions that told completely different sides of a very similar story. One man would ultimately plead guilty, and the other would be cleared when a jury found him not guilty. In what has to be one of the most disturbing, complicated, and frustratingly ill-covered mass disappearances in American history, the answers still remain obscured beneath the dust and decay of time, with the five young men's fate and whereabouts still unknown. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 62, The Disappearance of the Clinton Avenue Five. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. In sticking with October's theme of covering cases that have always disturbed me, today we examine the disappearance of the Clinton Avenue Five, a complicated case with not a lot of information available. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focusing on a different unsolved case each week. Subscribe and listen via Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcatchers. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter at traceevpod, on Instagram at traceevidencepod, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, social media links, merchandise, and more. Trace Evidence is also on Patreon, so if you'd like to support the show, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence, where you can get rewards such as stickers, pins, and commercial-free episodes. There's also a PayPal donation link on the website for those of you who don't wish to go through Patreon. This show is a complete one-man operation, and your support is greatly appreciated. This week, we examine the disappearance of five teenagers, a disturbing story that most people have never heard. It spans more than 40 years, and throughout all of that time, the haunting question of what became of five young men has lingered in the city of Newark, and specifically, with the families who lost the ones they love. This is Episode 62, The Disappearance of the Clinton Avenue Five. Newark, New Jersey is the seat of Essex County and holds the title of being the most populous city in the entire state having over 280,000 residents in just over 26 square miles. Newark sits approximately 11 miles to the west of New York City and is home to the headquarters of several major corporations, as well as multiple institutions of higher education, including Rutgers, the New Jersey Institute of Technology, and the law school established by Seton Hall University. Newark is divided into five political wards, named accordingly North, East, South, West, and Central, and this is often how residents refer to the particular neighborhood in which they live. The eclectic population of the city spans the array of social statuses and lifestyles, from busy streets of urban areas to the quiet comfort of suburban neighborhoods. Second only to Jersey City in terms of cultural diversity, Newark is a hotbed of people, points of view, and lifestyles. The Newark of today, though, is different than it used to be, and it's growing once again after many years of population decreases. Racial tensions between the African American population and the predominantly white police force of the 1960s led to many riots and violent confrontations. The white population of Newark dropped from 363,000 in 1950 to 158,000 by 1967, while its African American population grew from 70,000 to 220,000 in that same time. Unemployment, substandard housing, and political tensions combined with the exodus of the middle class ignited a powder keg of disenfranchised residents, which resulted in $10 million worth of property damage, 1,100 wounded, and 26 killed in riots and police confrontations in 1967 alone. Loss of jobs, violence, racial tensions, and corruption within the government structure of New Jersey itself initiated a mass exodus, with residents leaving in droves, and by the late 1970s, Newark's population, which had once neared 500,000, was now teetering near 330,000, a total loss of nearly 35% of its residents. By 1978, the impact of the economic decline and the exiting population led to a very different appearance than what we know today. Thousands of abandoned buildings dotted the landscape, and as they fell into disarray, they became the residence of homeless people, squatters, and drug users. As a result of decaying wiring, broken down structures, and illicit activities by people who weren't concerned about safety, building fires were extremely common. In just 1978, more than 2,600 vacant buildings were set ablaze, either intentionally or not, and it became such an overwhelming task to keep up with the local fire stations that they elected not to enter the vacant buildings when fires occurred. It was considered not worth the risk of a firefighter's life to enter one of the abandoned buildings, which, aside from the danger of the fire itself, also offered the threat of structural integrity. How many people, secrets, and crimes were lost amid the smoke and ash remains unknown and plays an integral role in the disappearance of the Clinton Avenue 5. Clinton Avenue runs from the intersection of Irvington and Parker Avenues in the west, through the Garden State Parkway, and stops at Lincoln Park, where it meets with Broad Street in the east. Clinton Avenue runs through a wide swath of residential housing, interspersed with parks and local businesses. Amongst the residents of this area of Newark were five young men in 1978. Melvin Pittman, who went by the name Ricky, and Ernest Taylor were both 17. Alvin Turner, Randy Johnson, and Michael McDowell were 16. The boys were described all around as good people who tended to stay out of trouble. Michael had a minor infraction on his record for having been involved in a fist fight, though the other four had never had an encounter with police. As was typical of the time, the young men often spent their summer days hanging out, cracking jokes, and playing basketball at the park. In their free time, and in order to acquire a few extra dollars, they would often do odds and ends jobs for local residents and business owners. One of their occasional employers was Lee Anthony Evans, a local carpenter who had recently become a father and changed the name of his business to Evans & Son. Evans himself will play a vital role in the case later. The group of teenagers had all grown up together and were fairly tight with one another. They attended school together, spent their free time together, and it was commonly said that you rarely saw one of them alone, for sure enough, as soon as he would come swinging around the corner of an avenue, at least one of the others was sure to be following along. Detective Everett Hairston would later explain, quote, "They were regular kids, came from solid families. Only one of the kids ever had a minor scrape with the law, and that was much earlier." End quote. On the morning of Sunday, August 20th, 1978, Randy Johnson had plans to hang out with a few friends for the early part of the day, and then in the afternoon, he will be meeting up with his four other friends at Westside Park, located just a few blocks north of Clinton Avenue, where they'd all arranged to play basketball. By all accounts, their plans went through, and all five were together in the park playing basketball throughout the afternoon. When the heat and hunger grabbed a hold of them, some of the teens decided they needed to head home for dinner, after which they planned to get a shower, change their clothes, and come back out to see what the night had to offer. Others planned to stick around, skipping the trip home and just planned to hang out until the others returned. According to reports of the time, the group of teens split up around 4 p.m. There was also that night the opportunity to make a few extra dollars, as Lee Anthony Evans had requested their assistance, supposedly to help move some boxes. According to local reports, the plan was allegedly for Evans to meet the boys at Clinton Avenue and Fabian Place, where they'd hop into the back of his truck and he'd drive them to his current residence. They'd load up boxes, then he'd drive them to his new residence, unload the boxes, and then pay them and drop them back off where he'd picked them up from. According to Evans, he dropped the boys off at 11 p.m. What actually occurred surrounding this event, what boxes were moved, if any, and who all was involved in the process, still remains a mystery and is debated today. There are some contradictions in terms of eyewitness accounts of when the teens were last seen. However, the commonly believed timeline exists as follows. Randy Johnson was last reported to have been seen walking down Fabian Place at approximately 7 p.m. Melvin Pittman did return home, at which time he grabbed dinner, changed his clothes, and said goodbye to his mother, exiting their home on Beverly Street sometime around dusk, which on that particular day occurred at 7:49 p.m. Shortly after, an eyewitness reported seeing Pittman walking past an ice cream parlor located on Fabian Place. A contractor located in the area later reported seeing Ernest Taylor, Michael McDowell, and Alvin Turner riding in the back of a pickup truck heading down Clinton Avenue. This witness knew the teens and had worked with them in the past and was certain of their identities in his later conversation with authorities. Michael McDowell's timeline is somewhat confusing, as he did return home at some point that evening. There's confusion about the teens being picked up for the job by Evans, which some accounts state that they were picked up and never seen again, and others reporting that they were in fact spotted after being dropped back off. In McDowell's case, he was reported to have returned home after being picked up by Evans. However, this account gets a little more confusing as, according to McDowell's mother, he returned to their East Orange home, changed his clothes, and then hopped into the back of a pickup truck. This report clearly indicates the time of this trip as being after 8 p.m. McDowell's mother explained that, due to the darkness of the night, she could not identify the vehicle nor its driver. She did state, though, that there was another young man in the back of the truck when McDowell entered it, though she could not identify this individual either. Another eyewitness later in the night, approximately at 11 p.m., reported seeing three of the teenagers once again near Fabian Place. According to police reports, it's believed that the three young men seen at this time were the same three who had been previously witnessed driving down Clinton Avenue, namely Taylor, McDowell, and Turner. To this day, despite extensive investigation into the matter, authorities still cannot say for sure if all five of the teenagers got back together that night after their basketball game. Evans claims all the boys were together and that he dropped them off where he'd picked them up from, but this can't be known for certain. In fact, there are no verified witnesses who can place all of them in the same place at the same time following their time in the park. Two other young men, Roderick Royster, then 16, later claimed that he and his younger brother had actually been in the back of the truck that night and planned on going along with the five teens, but that his father wouldn't allow it. In a telephone interview, Royster explained that his father had seen the two boys enter the truck, at which point he ordered them out of the vehicle and back to their home. In police reports of the time, Royster is actually referred to as Number 6, though his brother is never mentioned. It's interesting to note that despite Royster's statements, authorities at the time maintained that they could not verify the young men all being together in the truck. In addition to that, there's the contradiction that Evans claims he picked the boys up near Clinton Avenue and Fabian Place, though McDowell is later reported to have gotten into a truck which had driven to his home. Unfortunately, information regarding this case is notoriously difficult to come by, and so attempts to truly hash out what actually occurred at what time has been challenging. Detective Hairston later explained that, while they could not verify all five teens being together again that night, they do believe that whatever occurred to them happened at the same time. When none of the five returned home that evening, their parents were worried but not yet panicked. They knew that the teens often spent time together, and initially, it was considered a possibility that they may have simply spent the night together at one of their homes. It wasn't until a series of phone calls and visits in search of the boys occurred that the groups of parents learned the dark truth. No one had seen their sons since the night before, and no one had any indication of what may have happened to them. Janet Lawson, the mother of Michael McDowell, took to the streets. Though she didn't have a license, friends drove her throughout the city as she screamed her son's name out the window, but never received an answer. Through conversations with locals and other friends, the families were able to piece parts of the evening together, but the sightings were sporadic, and for the most part, no one was able to provide much assistance. When Evans, the man who said he'd hired them to move some boxes, was spoken to, he alleged to have paid the teens and dropped them all back off near an ice cream parlor on Clinton Avenue at 11 p.m., though for the most part, suspicions about his statements were aroused almost immediately. When police were contacted, it went, sadly, somewhat as you might expect things to go for a predominantly white police force investigating the strange disappearance of five young African-American men in 1978. The initial reaction was that the boys may have run away, or simply been out partying somewhere and would return home later. There was even a theory floating around that the teens may have stolen a vehicle and taken it for a joyride, and then either gone on the run to escape arrest, or perhaps even crashed into a body of water, though Detective Hairston considers this unlikely, explaining, quote, "If that had occurred, something would have surfaced by now. This is not the middle of Wyoming," end quote. However, the families disagreed with initial theories and felt it was extremely out of character for their sons to go missing. None of them had a history of running away, there were no charges pending they might be fleeing from, and while they were a group of young men who occasionally got into a little bit of trouble, they were certainly not the type to steal cars, party all night, or simply run off. It seemed clear to the families from the get-go that the case wasn't taken extremely serious. Even local media outlets wouldn't be notified for nearly a week, which would ultimately result in authorities' suspicions being raised when the family of Randy Johnson received a threatening phone call just a few days after the disappearance, before the media had reported it publicly. According to Detective Hairston, a collect call came into the home of Randy Johnson's family. When speaking with his parents, the caller, described only as an unknown male, discussed the disappearance of their son and the four other teens. This anonymous caller explained that the group of young men were being held in a youth house in connection with a truck heist. The man further explained that the boys were alive and that they would be set free if only the family would pay them $750. When police were informed of the call, two theories were immediately considered. The first was that the man on the other end must have had an intimate knowledge of the teen's whereabouts, since it hadn't been widely reported yet. The other was that the caller may have actually been one of the missing teens, and this may have been an attempt to get some money from the family for traveling purposes. Since the call had been made collect, police were able to trace it. The call had been made from a payphone located at the Union Railroad Station in Washington, D.C., some 200 miles to the southwest. Unfortunately, due to the time involved in tracing the call, by the time local units could be mobilized to check the area, the caller was long gone. Being 1978, there weren't cameras present, and it was considered unlikely that they'd be able to identify the caller. Whether or not individuals present in the station were questioned about seeing anyone on the phones is unknown, but to this day, the identity of that caller remains a mystery. In regard to the possibility that it may have been one of the teens in an effort to gain money for travel, Detective Hairston later said, quote, "Nothing was ever heard from anyone, so that theory was discounted," end quote. The parents of the teens all felt there was something suspicious about the man who claimed to have hired them for work that night, Lee Anthony Evans. The teens had all, together and separately, done work for him in the past, but the one through line which seemed to connect them was the theory that they had helped him move boxes that night, which he readily admitted. Under mounting pressure from the families, authorities spoke to Evans on multiple occasions. He was questioned extensively about the events of the evening, when he saw the teens, where he dropped them off, and what exactly had occurred. Investigators found his story suspicious as well, but they had no information to move forward with. When asked to take a polygraph, Evans agreed, and he was subsequently polygraphed several times according to authorities, and managed to pass each of them. When later asked about Evans and whether or not he was a suspect, police spokesman Danny Collins would neither confirm nor deny, and replied simply, quote, "We're exploring all possibilities," end quote. With Evans passing the polygraph tests and authorities unable to find any hard evidence to link him to the disappearance, there wasn't very much which could be done at the time. The case file on the disappearance began with only a few pages, though over the years it would become thicker and more extensive. Unfortunately, investigators had little to work with. They tracked the teens' social security numbers, though there was never any activity connected to them. Due to their age and the fact that they hadn't been in trouble with the law, they had no fingerprints for the teens to run through any systems. And also, they only had dental records for one of the teens, which would make the identification of a John Doe body complicated were they to ever find any which they believe could possibly be one of the teens. On November 18th, 1978, nearly 3 months to the day that the boys disappeared, the Jonestown Massacre occurred. Over 900 people died as the result of cyanide poisoning and murder when a cult, the People's Temple Agricultural Project, more frequently referred to as Jonestown, came to its bloody conclusion. Considering the proximity in time and the disappearance of the five teens going without explanation, it was initially considered a possibility that they may have been indoctrinated into the cult at some point and wound up amongst the dead. This, however, was ruled out when authorities examined the lists of the deceased and found no connections to the teens. This was, for the most part, the last major possibility in the case for many years. Over time, police interviewed hundreds of witnesses and claimed to have conducted dozens of polygraph tests to no avail. At various points in time, major searches had been undertaken. Rivers and lakes were searched by divers and dragged, but nothing was ever recovered. Countless searches into the thousands of abandoned buildings in Newark were also conducted, though again, there was nothing to show for it. Media attention was sent out nationwide at the time, and missing persons flyers were posted everywhere from Newark to California. And while hundreds of tips were called in, they failed to lead to any results. Detective Hairston later said, quote, "This is the most baffling case we've ever had. I find myself constantly checking the teletypes and bulletins to see if anything mentions the boys or could be related to this case." End quote. Slowly but surely, knowledge of the story began to fade, and while investigators left the case open, resources were withdrawn over time and refocused into other crimes. After 8 years of frustration, dead ends, and complete confusion over the disappearance, one person would bring up a possibility. In 1986, a woman by the name of Dorothy Allison came forward. A self-professed psychic, Allison worked with multiple law enforcement agencies around the country in homicide and missing persons cases. She spoke with investigators and informed them that she believed there was a likelihood that the boys had been murdered and that their bodies were buried in a field near Newark Airport. While authorities consulted with psychics on this case and others in the past, they didn't put a lot of weight into Allison's claims. Allison had, in 1968, assisted the Nutley, New Jersey police in locating a missing boy. The boy, sadly found deceased, was located in a drain pipe, and it's been stated that Allison led authorities straight to him. When asked about her abilities later, Nutley Police Chief Robert DeLitta commented, quote, "Cops are skeptics, but the information she gave us was accurate," end quote. There's a lot of differing opinions about the use of so-called psychics when investigating cases, and though it's difficult to say for certain either way, it's hard to put a lot of weight into their claims. For as many times that psychics have managed to lead investigators to an answer, there are innumerable times in which this has failed. At the time, Allison's claims were taken in by investigators, and the field she pointed to was looked at, but only in the form of a cursory examination. It wouldn't be until 10 years later, in May of 1996, that Allison would finally get her time with the Newark police, and with nearly 20 years having passed, authorities decided it might not be the worst idea to take a crack at her theory and see what, if anything, could be found. For 18 years, the residents of Newark had wondered what became of the teens, and with so much time gone, their story had become a cautionary tale, almost a myth, told to teenagers who came home late or got into trouble. For their families, however, it was a never-ending nightmare of wondering what became of their sons, brothers, and cousins. In hopes of finding answers, Detectives Armadin Tahaney and Angel Ramos, newly assigned to the case, decided to take a look at the field for themselves. In total, it sprawls more than 5 acres, dense with tall grass and refuse. Working in tandem with Allison, the detectives mapped out 10 locations in the field which would be designated for excavation. When asked why she believed this location might hold the key, Allison responded, quote, "I see teeth in the ground. I feel that the boys were burned after being killed. I don't know. Why did I say that about the teeth? I have to go by my feelings," end quote. The field itself is located between Interstate 78 and Route 22, just to the west of the New Jersey Turnpike. Ultimately, crews were brought out to the field for digging and cadaver dogs were employed in a broad search of the area, though the most focused searching took place in the areas on the map designated for excavation. The search took place on May 14, 1996. In total, 3 of the 10 marked sites were excavated, but nothing was recovered from those sites. In hopes of gaining more insight into the case and more knowledge about where to dig, the search was called off so that the lead detectives might re-question family, witnesses, and potential suspects. Unfortunately, no new information was gained, and it appeared that the other 7 marked sites in the field were not excavated. Not long after the search, Allison, who was 71 at the time, was presented with a plaque honoring her efforts to assist in the search. When asked about the plaque, Allison simply replied, quote, "I just want to find the boys," end quote. Once again, the case would grow cold, if indeed it had ever warmed up, and it would be 11 years before there was any additional movement. In June of 2007, authorities approached Terry Lawson, then sister of Michael McDowell, and were granted a DNA swab from her, which they hoped to use in tests against unidentified bodies and remains which were recovered. Multiple DNA samples were gathered from other victims' families in hopes that, someday, they might discover the answer as to what happened to the five teenagers. As the case file continued to grow and now included DNA, investigators felt that the chance they might find out the truth was growing more likely. Less than a year later, in January of 2008, Anthony Ambrose, the chief of detectives for Essex County, gave the go-ahead for a new team of investigators, comprised of state, county, and city authorities, to begin looking into the case, which by this time was commonly referred to as the missing Clinton Avenue 5. What spurned this large-scale, multi-department investigation remains a bit obscure, but there are several factors which likely played a role. There was a man named Maurice Woody Olds, who investigators had been looking at as a possibly being involved in the disappearance. Woody Olds had a distinct connection to two other men, which police felt they knew more than they had shared. The two men were Philander Hampton and his cousin, Lee Anthony Evans, the man who had apparently hired the teens to help him move the night they vanished. Rogers Taylor, the brother of the missing Ernest Taylor, claimed to have had a strange experience that same year of 2008. According to Taylor, he was working on a home as part of his job when he received a visit from Evans. Taylor says that Evans admitted that he had become a born-again Christian and he wanted to clear his conscience about an issue. When Taylor asked what it was about, he claims Evans told him, quote, "It's about the boys," end quote. Not wanting to be the only person as a witness to this statement, Taylor invited Evans to his sister's home, the same home where his brother had lived before he vanished. Also present, Taylor claims, was a Newark detective. According to Taylor, Evans got straight to the point, stating, quote, "He told me he did it, and he said it wasn't just him. There were some more people involved. He said he had to let me know what really happened," end quote. There is some confusion about this incident, as Evans wasn't immediately arrested, and police later denied that the confession had taken place in this manner. However, they were now supplied with information that they felt directed them towards the man they considered a possibility since day one. So what happened? Why wasn't he investigated further at the time? Well, as I mentioned previously, he had passed at least one polygraph test. As it turns out, though, no polygraph was ever given to Evans. Taylor later stated, quote, "The lie detector test was a lie," end quote. The families had always questioned the veracity of the test and shown their doubts, and were vindicated in a bittersweet acknowledgement when the truth about the polygraph, or lack thereof, finally came out. Investigators have said that the confession itself, assuming it took place as has been explained, was not enough to convict Evans. They needed more information and more evidence, and it was around this time that they received another confession with ties to Evans. Philander Hampton, Evans' cousin, was in jail at the time and decided that he wanted to confess. He felt that the weight of what had happened had ruined his life and that he'd been carrying it for so long, he wanted to get it off his chest. Hampton spoke with investigators and prison officials and during this time confessed that Evans had in fact murdered the five teenagers and that he had been complicit in the act, in fact luring the teens to the location of their murder. Following this confession, there were no arrests. The multi-department team working the case wanted to gather corroborating evidence and additional information if possible. For more than a year, they worked on building the case to the best of their abilities, and then finally, in March of 2010, warrants were issued and both Hampton and Evans were arrested. Each man was charged with 5 counts of murder and 5 counts of arson, and their bail was set beyond $1 million. In an attempt to lower his possible sentence, Philander Hampton became a cooperating witness and laid the entire horrible story out for investigators and the prosecution. According to Hampton, at the time of the disappearance, amongst the odd jobs that Evans was doing, he was also involved in the drug trade, specifically selling marijuana. Hampton went on to explain that on the afternoon that the five teenagers vanished, or possibly as early as a few days prior, Evans noticed that a pound of marijuana was missing from his home. It was his belief at the time that it had to have been stolen by the young men who often worked for him. Hampton claims that Evans confessed this to him, and that together, they were going to get the teens alone and scare them into confessing to the theft, returning the marijuana, and possibly going to go a bit further to scare the teens into never considering stealing from Evans again. Unfortunately, according to Hampton, Evans had an entirely different idea in mind. Hampton went on to explain that he helped lure the boys along the way by verifying the story about moving boxes. They were taken to an abandoned home located at 256 Camden Street. The abandoned home was located only a few miles to the northeast of Westside Park, where the teens had played basketball that afternoon, and just a few avenues north of Clinton Avenue. Hampton claims to have had a key to the abandoned home and that he often used it as a squatting location. Two of the boys were brought to the home first, at which point Hampton claims that Evans provided him with a gun to keep them there while he went out to gather up the other three. Once the boys arrived at the home, Evans is alleged to have taken the gun and began questioning them about the stolen drugs. He is also said to have been in possession of a 5-gallon can of gasoline when he returned. Hampton explained, quote, "I think he bought the gasoline when he went to get the three boys the last time he went out. He didn't buy the gas when I was with him." End quote. Details about what exactly was said haven't been revealed, but as Hampton explains, it was at this time that Evans corralled all of the teens into a small closet. Once inside, he's said to have nailed the door shut using a single nail. Hampton explained, quote, "I don't know exactly how long it was, but it was a big nail." End quote. With the teenagers locked in the closet, Evans then allegedly poured gasoline all over the door and throughout the house before utilizing a match, possibly provided to him by Hampton, to set the home ablaze with the teenagers alive and trapped inside. The home itself burned to the ground, and the structure was so damaged by the fire that much of it collapsed into the basement. Hampton did lead authorities to the location, though despite advances in technology over the 30 years, they were unable to recover any fragments of bone or anything to indicate that the murders had actually taken place there. Ground-penetrating radar was utilized, but again, no remains were discovered. The absence of human remains would play a large part in the later trial, though, as part of his plea deal, Hampton would testify against his cousin. Family members would partially verify some of the story by admitting that some marijuana had been found in each of the missing boys' rooms after their disappearance. The trial, however, did not go as authorities would have wanted. Evans' court-appointed lawyer and himself were able to mount a sizable defense. Their defense pointed out numerous inconsistencies in Hampton's testimony, as well as acknowledging the fact that he had been in jail at the time he confessed and had worked out a plea bargain for himself. Hampton himself had a long criminal history, had been involved in drugs, abusing heroin and other substances, and his credibility came under attack. Amongst the inconsistencies in his story was the fact that he claimed that the boys were murdered no later than 9 p.m., though witnesses saw some of the teens as late as 11. The prosecution called multiple detectives, most of whom were retired, who testified that from day one, Evans had been their only suspect, though they'd never had the evidence to prove he was responsible. While the prosecution worked hard, they also made some mistakes, including bringing up information that the judge had ruled would not be in the trial. In one instance, the prosecution brought up the fact that Evans' brother had been convicted of murder, though this had been ruled inadmissible since his brother was deceased at the time. In another, an officer testifying was led to make a statement about a witness to the fire, though this witness's statement was also inadmissible because he also had died since then. In 2008, shortly after his confession, Hampton had called Evans from a police department in an attempt to get him to admit to the crime on tape. Evans had responded by asking, "What in the world are you talking about?" And Evans admitted this recording as evidence at the trial. The jurors felt that his response seemed believable, and since the prosecution hadn't admitted it, it was almost as though they were trying to hide something. Evans also informed the jury, during closing arguments, that he had been offered a much smaller sentence if he'd only confess, but that he'd turned it down because he was not guilty. Ultimately, Evans was able to provide questions to the jury that there simply weren't good answers for. Among these questions were, why would he use his business truck, which had his name on the side, if he was going to be driving young men to a murder? How could he have gotten all of them into the closet without a fight, even if he had brandished a handgun? He and Hampton would have been outnumbered 5-2. The biggest question, though, and one which went directly against Hampton's testimony, was how would it be possible for five young men to be locked in a closet with the use of only a single nail? Evans also helped produce reasonable doubt by discussing reported sightings of a man with a gun in the company of the teens the day they vanished, an angry drug dealer out for revenge against them, and contradictory witness statements about the fire they were allegedly killed in. Evans also argued that it was a conspiracy, including corrupt officials, to pin a crime on him because they couldn't solve it. In November of 2011, a Newark jury found Evans not guilty on all charges. Juror Lenny DeLeo later explained, quote, "Most people believe there just wasn't enough evidence to say beyond a reasonable doubt that he was involved," end quote. According to DeLeo, on Friday, the first day of deliberations, the vote was split 6-6 in terms of guilt or innocence. By the following Wednesday, the vote was 11-1 in favor of an acquittal, and finally the one vote agreed with the 11, and they settled on a ruling of not guilty. For DeLeo, one of the keys to the case was the testimony of Hampton, which he explained most jurors found simply unreliable. That, in addition to the fact that he would serve a maximum sentence of 10 years, though more likely he would only serve 2, and that he would be awarded $15,000 following his release from prison so that he could relocate, and this made his testimony seem purposefully slanted. The families, or what remains of them some 33 years later, cried and consoled one another in the courtroom when Evans was dismissed. Michael McDowell's sister, Terry Lawson, spoke to reporters, saying, quote, "Not guilty does not mean innocent. Mr. Evans may have escaped the law, but never the Lord. We're grateful this case was brought in front of a jury. It's difficult to ask 12 people to go back 33 years. We stand here today with more information with what happened to our boys," end quote. When asked about the family, specifically her mother, who had since passed away, Lawson responded, quote, "33 years ago, I was a child who watched her big brother disappear into the night. Today, I stand here a woman, a mother myself. I can't imagine the pain my mother endured not knowing what happened to her only son," end quote. While for many, the likelihood of what happened to the five young men has been determined, regardless of how the jurors decided, there are many questions which remain unanswered. Whether or not one could depend on Hampton's testimony as enough to prove the truth of what occurred remains hotly debated. In a case such as this, where almost every law enforcement and legal professional involved believes that a man got away with five murders, there are truly only two theories which exist. The first theory suggests that Lee Anthony Evans may have been responsible, but somehow found a way to wrangle out of it through his trial. The second theory, and the only other alternative ever given, is that the five young men met their untimely end through the actions of a yet unknown or unnamed suspect. Whether or not this was related to drugs, the friends' relationships, or via a completely random encounter remains to be discovered, if indeed true. The disappearance of the Clinton Avenue Five is an absolutely heartbreaking and shocking case. It tells the story of five young men, Melvin Pittman, Ernest Taylor, Alvin Turner, Randy Johnson, and Michael McDowell, who left their homes one summer night in 1978 and never returned. Some 33 years later, a man pled guilty to his involvement in their murders, but the man indicated as being the one most responsible was found not guilty due to a lack of evidence and so many questions and contradictions. For their families, many of them are now gone. They lost their lives never knowing what happened to their sons, their brothers. For those who remain, they have lived through the horrible details of what may have happened to them. And while knowledge can often lead to closure, if indeed their suspicions are correct and Lee Anthony Evans committed this crime, a jury felt there was simply not enough evidence to convict, and he's now free, still living in the same area that he had lived since the day the Clinton Avenue 5 vanished. To this day, not a single shred has ever been found to reveal their location, and their families have no memorial sites to visit and no graves to lay flowers on as they continue to mourn 40 years later.
Hi, this is Mike Ferguson.
And this is Mike Morford.
And we'd like to invite you to check out our true crime podcast, Criminology.
In each season of Criminology, we take a deep dive to tackle some of the biggest cases in the history of true crime using classified police files and interviews with investigators, experts, victims, and survivors, all in an effort to accurately and completely examine the cases we cover.
And season 4 of Criminology is out right now. We're taking on cases solved in 2018 using DNA with the help of resources like Parabon, GEDmatch, and Forensic Genealogy. And we've got some great interviews this season with people like Paul Holes, who helped bring down the Golden State Killer, Curtis Rogers, founder of GEDmatch, Steve Armentrout, the CEO of Parabon, and Colleen Fitzpatrick, a forensic genealogist who's had a hand in solving some of these cases.
Past seasons of Criminology are available to binge, including in-depth coverage of the Zodiac Killer, the Golden State Killer, and Ted Bundy.
New episodes drop Saturdays at 10 o'clock p.m., and you can find and subscribe to Criminology on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app.
I first became aware of this case many years ago when I was still living in New York. It wasn't the kind of case that was gaining headlines, and there certainly wasn't a lot of verified information available about it. It came to me, as I imagine it came to others, as a story to be told to scare you. Whether it was from parents, teachers, or friends, it was the story of five young men who went out one night and never came home. Now, when I heard it, it had already been 20 years since the boys had vanished, so it certainly wasn't a new story, but I became fascinated by it and tried to look into it. The internet, in its infancy, didn't offer a ton of options, but even now, all these years later, it's still difficult to dig into this case and find any information. While many of you enjoy my analysis of theories and cases I've covered in the past, this one's extremely difficult to examine. You'd think that when charges are filed against two men in connection to a disappearance that happened 33 years earlier, you'd hear a little more about it. While I could speculate as to why this case wasn't covered that well, I'm sure many of you already have your own ideas. This case is different than many I've covered in that, for the most part, people believe they know exactly what happened. Despite the outcome of the trial, the families and most of the authorities involved in investigating the disappearance are firm believers that Lee Anthony Evans was the man responsible. The question, of course, for anyone who examines this story is whether or not you believe that's what happened. The mystery, however, lies more in the where than the who at this point in time. Even if you believe Evans committed this terrible and atrocious crime for which he was acquitted, that doesn't lead us to the boys themselves. The first theory in this case happens to be the most popular, that Lee Anthony Evans, despite the results of the legal proceedings, may have murdered the five young men. Taking us back some 40 years now, Evans was 25 years old and running his own business, Evans & Son. He did mostly carpentry and odd jobs, though later he would get involved in plumbing and other aspects related to home repair and construction. Oftentimes, to assist him with his work, it wasn't uncommon for Evans to hire local teenagers to do some of the heavy lifting. All five of the boys had worked with him before, doing odd jobs. One of the theories, which has been floated in connection with the relationship between Evans and the boys, is whether or not drugs were involved in that work. Rumors have circulated from time to time that in addition to helping with construction jobs, the boys may have aided Evans in drug dealing. I've never found anything to verify these claims, though their parents did say that marijuana was found in their bedrooms. Most people, though, have always assumed that the marijuana found there was for personal use and not connected to any kind of drug dealing. These were not kids running around with a lot of cash to flash, and if they were involved in the drug trade, they weren't making a whole lot of money doing it. Either way, Hampton would later claim that Evans found a pound of marijuana was missing from his apartment, and he automatically believed that it had to be the boys who had stolen it. On the surface, this is a premise which seems to fit. Guy uses kids to do some work for him, is secretly dealing marijuana on the side, and gets angry when he thinks he's been robbed. However, there are issues with this. Firstly, authorities were suspicious of Evans from early on and went so far as to question him and even have him followed for periods of time. If he was dealing drugs, you'd think they'd have picked up on that pretty quick. Nailing someone with a major drug charge and then utilizing that to gain leverage for information about another crime is a fairly standard practice. Evans, though, wasn't busted for this alleged drug involvement, if indeed it happened at all. Now, it's also difficult to know just how thoroughly he was followed or investigated at the time, due to a number of factors. So, according to Hampton, Evans' cousin, when he suspected the boys of stealing the drugs, his plan was to lure them to an abandoned home, where he would get them to confess to stealing, force them to give his drugs back, and then put the fear of God in them so they never considered stealing from him again. Of course, if Hampton's story is true, Evans would also have made the decision at some point that that wouldn't be enough, and he would need to kill the boys as well. It's difficult to argue the points and counterpoints of this particular concept, as it's not exactly uncommon for a drug dealer to kill people who steal from him. The problem for me, though, is the nature of the crime itself. Remember those questions Evans asked of the jury at his trial? Let's run through them quickly. Firstly, why would he take the five boys to the house to murder them in a truck bearing his name on the side with the knowledge that there'd likely be a chance at least some of the boys would have told their parents who they were going with? Now, there's two angles to that. Either no one would be that stupid, or a person who would do that didn't think it through and just figured he'd get away with it. This is a racially divided 1978 Newark, New Jersey. It probably wasn't all too common to see the cops come swarming down the streets to investigate the disappearance of an African American, let alone five teenage boys. Then he asked, how could he have gotten all five boys into the closet without them fighting back? Well, that seems pretty clear. They knew Evans, and while they may have been frightened by the gun, they may not have thought they were going to get murdered. Part of the problem with this story is, if it's true, we never find out if the boys were questioned, what they said, any of the intricate details that might help explain this. Controlling a group of people with a single gun is really a matter of instilling fear and balancing that with hope. If they believed that they had a chance to survive, it's unlikely they were going to rush the guy. They're 16 and 17. He's 25, and if he's the kind of guy who's dealing drugs and carrying guns around, there's also the chance that they wouldn't want to make him mad and end up shot by trying to fight back, if they believed there was a chance they could survive. The nail issue is a problem for me also. I do find it difficult to imagine you could nail a closet door shut with a single nail, and that the panicked fighting of five young men couldn't bust the door open, especially once the fire had started. It's hard to judge because we don't know how much room was in the closet. Whether the boys were all crushed together, or if they had room to move, to kick, or to slam their shoulders against the door. If they were crammed in there really tight, then yes, I could see a single nail doing the job, even though it still seems hard to believe. Hampton's description of it is really odd also, because he refers to it as a really long nail. I wish we had a little more detail about just how long he claimed it was. Also, for me, an issue with his story is that he never mentions Evans going back outside, so you'd have to assume that when he entered, he had the hammer and nail with him along with the gun and the gas. Again, there's just a lot of details that don't fit. Also, if you're going to try and force these guys into the closet, would you be carrying the gas can with you, as he was alleged to have done? It just doesn't make a lot of sense. So many questions, not enough answers. Mix that in with the decay of memory over 33 years, and it's very difficult to know what exactly may have happened here. The story, regardless of its veracity, was essentially what authorities wanted to hear. They had long suspected Evans of being involved, so when his own cousin claimed he had committed that crime, that must have felt like one of the biggest breaks they could ever ask for. There was no mention of Maurice Woody Olds in Hampton's testimony, though authorities also believe that he may have been involved in the disappearance. Therefore, it's been argued that all three men were responsible for the crime. Woody Olds was deceased by the time charges were filed, and very little has been discussed in terms of his possible involvement, but that adds the possibility that he could have helped control the boys, he could have supplied the hammer and nail, he could have been wielding a gun. We simply don't know. Despite what you may believe, Evans presented a strong defense and countered almost all the evidence against him. In reality, though, there wasn't much evidence to begin with. The case hinged almost entirely on Hampton's testimony, and once his character had been deconstructed, and the jury was faced with choosing what they actually believed, most of them felt that while his story was strong, it didn't convince them beyond the shadow of a doubt. We know our legal system, and for all of its flaws, it can often involve a process which is fair and balanced. Whether or not that was the case in terms of this trial, that's hard to say. Hampton's testimony was compelling, but it had holes in it which couldn't be filled, and there was no other party who could corroborate his story. In a bitter twist of irony, it rings familiar to some testimony we've seen in the media lately, and debates about guilt, innocence, and innocence until proven guilty. After the boys' disappearance, Evans stayed in the area. He continued to work construction, built his family, and became a part of the community. Despite this, suspicions about his involvement always existed, and his 2010 arrest in relation to the disappearance certainly worked to make him appear like an even more likely suspect in the public eye. Despite being acquitted, most people continued to believe he had committed the crime. When examining a case, I do my best to look at the evidence, the angles, and to try and be balanced in determining the likelihood or unlikelihood of someone's guilt. In this case, that's very difficult to do because there simply isn't much evidence available. It really comes down to whether or not you believe Hampton or Evans. One critical detail which makes it hard is the lack of remains discovered at the location. Police searched extensively and could find nothing. No clothing, no hair, no teeth. That certainly presents a challenge in determining if the story is true or not, even if it has been 33 years since the murders alleged to have taken place. With all that said, Evans certainly had the ability to commit this crime. He had a relationship with the boys. He's known to have asked them to work for him that night. He admitted that he was with them, and he is one of the last people who can confirm seeing them. One angle I've always found curious is the sixth boy, Roderick Royster. He has, on several occasions, claimed to have been in the truck that night along with his brother until his father ordered them out of it. Was Evans planning to kill seven boys and not just the ones who supposedly stole from him? Was Royster considered someone who had stolen from him, and if so, why did he let him live on after that? That detail has always given me pause. Ultimately, I believe Evans certainly had the ability, the availability, and the means by which to commit this murder. Whether or not he actually did, that's a question we may never know the answer to. There's just not enough information, and sadly, there might never be. The second theory has pretty much no evidence, and at best is called speculation, because theory might be too strong of a word. It's all based around the possibility that Evans may not have committed this crime, which would dictate that it had to have been committed by someone else. An interesting angle to this possibility is that Hampton himself may have been responsible for the crime, which was sort of what Evans argued in court, and only later tried to pin it on his cousin for reasons unknown. Either way, it's a theory which is due examination, as shallow as it may necessarily be due to a lack of almost any evidence whatsoever. It's not easy to control someone. To execute and eliminate 5 people at once is a completely different challenge, and then to get rid of the bodies all in that same night is nearly impossible. Even police have spoken out over the years, their belief that this was likely not a crime committed by a single person. Considering the mass amounts of abandoned buildings in the area, the open field that the alleged psychic had directed authorities towards, and certainly wilderness and vacant areas not too far away, the list of places that the boys could have ended up is certainly extensive depending upon who committed the crime and how long they had to do it and cover it up. It seems rather unlikely that a random person would just come across the 5 boys and decide he wanted to abduct or murder them. They were in their hometown, on the streets they knew, surrounded by people they'd known for most of their lives. This wasn't a group of kids wandering around in an unknown area, and there certainly weren't any reports that night which would indicate that there was a struggle, screams, or anything else which may be associated with an abduction, a mugging gone wrong, a fight. Authorities tried to look at every possibility, including the lists of the deceased found at the Jonestown massacre. Just 4 months after the boys vanished, John Wayne Gacy was arrested, and Newark police were actually in communication with Illinois police about the possibility that the boys may have been there. Obviously, they were not. So, under what scenario could it have been someone other than Evans? It would either have had to have been someone the boys trusted, or possibly Hampton, who was connected to Evans and may have, for some reason, wanted to murder them. Unfortunately, it's entirely speculative. Hampton claims to have been there. He gave intricate details, though some were contradictory, and so it becomes a question of, if indeed he had committed this crime, why would he have come forward in the first place? Evans thought that perhaps his cousin was trying to pin it on him in order to leverage himself out of charges on a different matter, though that wouldn't make a ton of sense since he would have to do time for this crime anyway. I'd love to know for certain which crime involved a longer sentence, but it's never been revealed what Hampton was in jail for in the first place, though many assume it was a drug charge. Ultimately, this is less a question of did someone else commit the crime and more about was it possible. You can't exactly say it's impossible, and while the case is slanted so heavily towards Evans being the prime suspect, and perhaps with reason, there are a multitude of possibilities here. Anything from a drug deal gone bad to a racially charged crime. It's not my place to tell you what happened, at least not in regard to who may have been responsible. I do my best to weigh the options, and while the idea of an unknown suspect, or group of them, being involved is absolutely there, if we're going purely on what information is available, then Evans seems like the most likely suspect. On the other hand, we know that a court of law found him not guilty, not perhaps because he didn't commit the crime, but because there simply wasn't enough evidence to truly connect him to it. Does that leave the door open for the possibility of a completely different unknown scenario? Absolutely. One angle of the disappearance that I find extremely haunting, and that unfortunately there's again not much to say about, is that mysterious phone call in the days after the boys vanished. Some believe it was the boys themselves, though over the years that theory was rejected. Others felt that it may have been someone playing a prank, though they'd have to know the story, and not many people outside of Newark did, and this call originated from Washington, D.C. Could this phone call indicate the possibility that someone else was involved, or was it only someone trying to extort money from a distraught family? Yet another angle to this story we simply cannot know the answer to. The disappearance of the Clinton Avenue 5 is a terrible case that can drive you absolutely insane. There's so much information which guides you one way, but not enough to get you all the way there. On the other side of the spectrum, endless possibilities which can neither be confirmed nor denied. What we know for certain is, 5 young men went out into the night 40 years ago and never returned home. The lives they could have led were taken from them. The families they could have grown old with were destroyed by their absence. Their potential, their dreams, their hopes and wishes were all gone due to someone's vicious and horrible choices. For the families, Evans was their man. They believe they know the truth now, even if the man they believe was responsible will never serve a day in jail for it. Of course, what actually happened, how it occurred, and where their brothers and sons are has yet to be resolved. I can't imagine loving someone and going 40 years without those answers, without a place to visit, without a place to properly mourn, without the ability to give a funeral and a proper burial. What those families have endured is absolutely devastating, and for the boys themselves, 16, 17, their lives hadn't even begun yet. This case is reminiscent of some of the most major unsolved cases you can examine. Few details, compelling suspects, contradictory arguments, evidence, but not quite enough, possibilities, but almost nothing to base them on. I hate to say it, but without more information, a confession which can be verified, a piece of physical evidence, the discovery of remains, this is a case which may linger under the title of unsolved forever. Authorities feel that the case is closed. They believe they have the answers. It becomes a matter of what you believe. In a case this complicated, this sad, this disturbing and shocking, you think there'd be more to say. But like so many cases out there, the evidence just isn't within anyone's grasp. So you get stories, rumors, confessions, and tales about what happened, but that all comes down to what you can prove versus what you believe. This case has stuck with me for a very long time, and honestly, I waited for someone else to cover it. I thought perhaps someone might find more information than me, might have more information or insight than me. Perhaps that will still occur, and perhaps someday all of the information will come out, and we will discover the absolute truth. Until that time comes, this case remains a haunting mystery, revolving around the fate of 5 young men and the question, where are the Clinton Avenue 5? If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of the Clinton Avenue 5, Melvin Pittman, Ernest Taylor, Alvin Turner, Randy Johnson, and Michael McDowell, there are some online resources available. Several New Jersey-based newspapers have articles covering the case, and the New York Times has archived some articles from the 1980s and 90s, but there isn't a great deal of information out there. If you have any information about the disappearance of the Clinton Avenue 5, please contact the FBI or Newark Police Department. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. I want to give a special shout out to Patreon producers Krista Colvin, Diane Dyson, Kate Alexander, Lucy LaRue, Lynn Merschel, and Sarah Burrow. Make sure you check your emails, as I'm awaiting responses from several of you regarding your trace evidence gear. Your support makes this show possible. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence, visit patreon.com/traceevidence. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate and review the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you're using. The more ratings and reviews the show gets, the more people are able to hear these unsolved cases. For more information about other cases, transcripts, media, and more, please visit the website at trace-evidence.com. This completes this week's episode. I want to remind you that Trace Evidence is available on Spotify now, so make sure you go and check it out there. Also, please visit truecrimelist.com and give Trace Evidence a vote. It would certainly help grow the podcast, and I'd really appreciate it. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.